El siguiente es un programa pagado por el anunciante y 1600 AM no se hace responsable por las opiniones reflejadas en su contenido.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Dermogradichian. I'm glad you're with us today for another episode in our program. This program is produced out of the KGST Multicultural 1600, but it's part of the Armenian Studies Program out at Fresno State. And so I'm really happy to be with you here today. My guest today is Dr. Christina Maranci, and she is the Dadian and Ustamel Professor of Armenian Art and Architecture in the Department of History of Art and Architecture at Tufts University. So welcome to our program today, Christina.
Carlo, I'm very glad to be here. I love the title, All Things Armenian.
All Things Armenian, that's it.
It's a great title.
It is. Thank you. So today I wanted to start off by talking a little bit about you. And I think that your chair in Armenian Art and Architecture is the only such chair mm-hmm. perhaps in the United States.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about what you actually do, what you teach?
Yeah,
and,
sure.
Maybe a little bit about the chair itself.
Yeah, of course. So I got the chair in 2008, and I was handed over the reins by Lucy Dermanuelian, the famous Lucy Dermanuelian, who actually not only held the chair before me, but actually raised all the funds for it as well, which is an amazing feat that only Lucy Dermanuelian could come up with. And so anyway, she is the one who sort of masterminded the idea for the chair. I think it was in the 90s that it started as a rotating position that moved around from like McGill, Harvard, BU, until it finally sort of settled on Tufts. And from that time, she held it, and now I do. And it is, to my knowledge as well, the only chair of its type outside of Yerevan. So my focus, my entire reason for being is to teach and study Armenian art. So it is for me, it's a perfect position. And, of course, you know, when you're looking for a job, the timing has to be right. So I'm very thankful that I was at the right place at the right time to get that job. I teach Armenian art, and I teach a general survey of Armenian art. I'm a medievalist, so my interests are pretty much pre-18th century, everything before then. So I teach a survey of Armenian art that goes from the prehistory, so dealing with all the wonderful archaeology, from before the Christian period all the way up until about the 17th and 18th centuries. And then I do a lecture on cultural heritage and, you know, the memory of the past as seen through the genocide. And that's usually my last lecture. And that is my survey course. And then I teach a seminar. I teach a bunch of seminars on Armenian art, all different things, from manuscripts to architecture to wall paintings. We just did one on wall paintings. So, yeah, so those are my course offerings. And this year, and I also train MA students. I should say, unfortunately, we don't have a doctoral program in my department, but We do have MAs, so I have been really honored to work with some wonderful master's students who are now in doctoral programs, and I have even have a new, newly hatched master's student. I guess, I don't know what you'd say, she's hatched. She's coming in the fall, I hope, right. To work with me on Armenian art, so I'm really excited about that. So, yeah, so it's a BA and MA program focused. My focus is Armenian art, and that's what I do.
Well, interested to know, I was looking at your CV, and you graduated from both Princeton and earlier from Vassar as well, but you always were in art. Can you pinpoint a time in your early life when you kind of got interested in art? Was it one event, one place you traveled to?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. So when I was very little, like so many Armenian children, my parents had books by CRP Nernerset. They had this Armenian miniatures book. I remember looking through that when I was little. But I was also very interested in drawing. I was obsessed with horses, also like many little girls. And so I would draw all the time. And I really loved my life drawing classes. And so I loved anything visual. And I loved exploring an object by drawing it. And that's not so different from what an art historian starts by doing, and that is looking very closely. So you'll find a lot of art historians sort of started their lives as artists, and I'm no exception there. So that was already kind of bred into me from when I was a kid drawing. And we didn't have, and this is true, I think, across the country, we didn't have art history courses in high school. So I wasn't exposed to even what art history was. I had no idea such a discipline existed. And it was only, you know, it's a funny story, if I can take a little time. Mm-hmm. I actually started college. I started college. My first year was at Kenyon College, which is in Ohio, and I thought I wanted to be an English major because that's what my brothers were also in college. But anyway, I was also a bit of a party girl, I have to admit. So I didn't spend too much time on my studies, and actually I didn't end up going back to Kenyon College. I ended up instead going to a community college, to University of Connecticut at Stamford. And it was there that I happened to take my first course in art history. It was an art appreciation, actually. And I'll never forget it, because that for me felt like the absolute right fit. You know, here I was in the dark looking at, you know, works of art and talking about them. And all of a sudden history made sense, and religion made sense, and culture made sense, and geography made sense, and it was just unbelievable. So that was my kind of really unexpected introduction to art history. And then I majored in it when I returned to college. I went to Vassar College and then moved on from there to Princeton, as you mentioned. But it was really that kind of complete, just sort of chance taking of a course that started me on my path. And I even remember the professor of that art appreciation course saying, you know, none of you are going to major in art history, but I just want you to know something about the subject. So,
and did you, and you talked about looking at the books when you were younger, seeing CRP, but how did your, how was your family in terms of its Armenian identity and your involvement in Armenian things?
Yeah,
was that there, or was that something you gained later? Or?
You know, I did gain it later. You know, my mom grew up in Boston, the child of my grandmother who was from Baiburt, Baperts. Mm-hmm. And her father was from Shabin Garahisar. But she grew up wanting to be American and, you know, not wanting to go to the beach with saucepans full of pilaf. She wanted, like, you know, a bottle of Coke and a hot dog and to be like everybody else. So she, you know, she didn't really push any of us to learn Armenian. We did go to Armenian church, but she didn't really push us hard. And my father grew up in Istanbul with a very different situation. And both of them met and really fell in love, in part because of their shared interest in European culture. So they had the three of us. We grew up in Connecticut. There weren't a whole lot of Armenians around. And although we did go to Armenian church, we weren't really impressed with or imprinted with Armenian culture at home with them. It was only when we would go to my grandparents in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, we would get more of the kind of different dimensions of being Armenian. And I don't blame, I guess it would be easy to say, oh, you know, shame on my parents, but they were coming, they have their own stories, and they were coming out of their own traumas as being children of genocide survivors. So I don't blame them. And what I do, you know, what I did starting in graduate school was learn the language, learn to read and write, and really fall in love on my own with medieval Armenian culture. And it just keeps happening day after day. So, and now, you know, my parents are still alive. They're in their 80s. We talk in Armenian, and we talk about, Armenian art and architecture. My mother came with me to Armenia once. So it's just funny how things turn around. But yeah, it was, you know, sort of learning about Armenian traditions and culture, aside from the church, was something that I did later as I discovered Armenian art and decided I wanted to do that. I wanted to do that for, for my life.
And did you, when you were going to college and you were getting your master's and ultimately a PhD, and maybe even afterward, who would you say was the first person that really impressed you, influenced you in the field of Armenian art?
Yeah, that's easy. It was Tom Matthews. This is another kind of funny story about my education, but it just goes to show you sometimes things look bad in the moment, but then they turn around. So I actually, Barlow, when I was in college, I thought I wanted to do Gothic architecture. I majored in art history, and I loved Romanesque and Gothic architecture. And so I thought I wanted to go on and do my PhD in Gothic architecture at Columbia. And so I applied, and I got in to study with a very famous expert on Gothic architecture, Stephen Murray. But I couldn't go because they didn't give me any money, and it was just going to be impossible. So I thought, I'll wait a year, I'll work in New York City, and live at home with my parents and make money, and then I'll go back. They'll accept me again. Well, long story short, I got a rejection letter the second time around, and it was horrible, and I didn't know what to do with myself. Mm-hmm. So I remember, just being kind of traumatized, and then picking myself up and starting to go and look around at other programs and try to strengthen my own application, retake the GREs and all those good things. But I remember I happened to be in New York with my mom, and we stopped by the Institute of Fine Art, which is like right opposite the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's the best doctoral program in the country for art history. And it was the summer, but we just wandered in, and I talked to the secretary, and for some reason I mentioned that I was interested in Armenian art, and I don't really know, where they came from, but she said, oh, you should talk to Tom Matthews. He's here right now. And so I did, and through him I met Nina Garsoyan, and Nina and Tom really took me under their wings. I ended up going with Nina to Kars, Ani, Tyke, all over, and I didn't know anything then yet, but it was an amazing thing now when I look back on it that I was traveling with Nina at Ani, walking around. So I would say Tom and Nina, if I could add a second, were my first experiences with mentors who end up really being big parts of my career and my life, and the reason that I'm here today. I wouldn't if it weren't for them, and it reminds me that that whenever students come to me in similar situations, how important it is to support them and reassure them and encourage them. So that's what I try to do as well.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because sometimes a student from many years ago will come and say, you know, it's because you said this and whatever, and you could hardly remember it sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a nice feeling, and that really makes the teaching part of it worthwhile.
Absolutely.
Now, your research interests are in, you said, in medieval and earlier Armenian art. How did you decide to go in that direction rather than perhaps the more modern?
I'm going to go back to college. I loved Italian Renaissance art, and in fact, I remember loving Titian and Venetian art in particular. And it was really so. Then I took a course on Romanesque and Gothic sculpture, and Romanesque and Gothic, particularly Romanesque, can look really ugly and weird and sort of distorted and abstract when you're not used to it. You just think, what is this? And I remember fighting with myself, like, why am I taking this class? These figures are so stretched, or they're so ungainly, or they don't look naturalistic like classical or Renaissance art. I remember sort of realizing that it was sort of the work of trying to understand medieval art. Why does it look the way it does? It's not immediately, you know, like, it doesn't give you that eye candy in a way that, like, classical sculpture does. But, you know, in a way, the work of learning about this subject and learning to love it, learning to love abstraction, is what drew me first to medieval, I'll say, to medieval European art. And it was really after that that I started to explore other cultures' medieval art, including Armenia. So it was in the beginning, that time period already fascinated me. And then later came the geographical and cultural diversity of looking at Armenia, also looking at the Byzantine Empire. I love the deeper past as well. I love, because honestly, Barlow, it's funny you ask this, because I'm finishing right now a paper on Surenians and the Hamidian massacres, mm-hmm. And looking at one of his paintings, mm-hmm. of the victims of the Hamidian massacres, and the modern period is just so terribly, terribly sad. I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I could work on that subject. And I know we have some wonderful scholars who work on the genocide, but for me, I love the deeper past. Not to say that there weren't tragedies then too, but they're just farther from me. I think those are some of the reasons that I love the Middle Ages. And the ancient world,
and your focus,
and they're endlessly complex.
Yeah, and your focus is more on architecture, right?
My focus is on architecture, which I love too. But right. It was also something that I had to learn, and a lot of students can be intimidated by architecture because of those weird ground plans, and it just looks strange. You have to learn to read ground plans as you do anything else, you know, any other kind of graphic thing, but. But again, Tom Matthews played a really crucial role in making architecture come alive for me. And I brought that with me to my study of Armenian architecture. I remember him saying that buildings, particularly churches, are envelopes for movement. And that really struck me, I remember, when he said it. And just it made me think about buildings in a different way, not just as, you know, empty shells or masses, but spaces in which movement it happens. So architecture is my first love, I would say. But you know, with Armenian architecture, it's the whole bag. Armenian architecture isn't just buildings, it's inscriptions, it's paintings, it's sculpture, it's liturgy, it's landscape, it's so many things. So it's sound, it's music. It's really the whole picture you get, and it's also patronage. So I see it as these churches are like small worlds unto themselves, and I love them for that reason too.
That's great. My guest today is Dr. Christina Maranti. She's a professor of Armenian Art and Architecture at Tufts University. We're going to take a brief break from All Things Armenian, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Dermogradichian. Over the break, we were listening to Hoy Nazan, which was a piece sung by the Yerevan Women's Choir of Armenia. It's from a CD that they have, and conducted by Arthur Veranyan. So we're listening to some Armenian music today while we are interviewing and discussing Armenian art and architecture with my guest. My guest is Dr. Christina Maranci. She's a professor of art and art architecture at Tufts University. Welcome back again, Christina.
Thank you, Barlow. It's great to be back.
So we were talking about art and how you got interested in art. And it seems like when you look at your CV that your work is very much involved in also getting interested in sort of individual maybe monuments, let's say, of Armenian architecture. And I'm thinking of a few of them, such as Maran, Ani, of course, the entire cathedral and other places. Tell us a little bit about that part of your research.
Yeah, sure. So I and this sort of goes to what we were talking about before the break. I love looking really, 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 really closely at something and building out from some really close observation of, let's say, a monument. And what I've tried to do, and this kind of relates to the work that I did from my Vigilant Powers book, but also a bunch of studies that I've made, as you mentioned, Ani Cathedral and different churches. I'm really interested in doing close analysis of a single monument looking at architecture, looking at inscriptions, looking at what we know from chronicles, what we know, what we can glean about who made it, why it was made, when it was made, why it was made, where it was made, what we can say about its decoration. Decoration isn't a great word because it sort of implies something pretty that's an add-on, and that's a very modern way of thinking about medieval Armenian architecture. The sculpture and the painting was really part of the whole experience of the church. So just that's a little footnote. But yeah, I truly believe that when you're trying to understand a complex phenomenon, whether it's the 7th century and the global wars of the 7th century or Armenian-Byzantine relations of the 10th, 11th centuries, that you're starting really small, you know, I guess some people call it a microhistory, starting really small is and then building is a great way to go, because you can't apply any big generalizations before you're ready. So for example, with Vigilant Powers, that the book I wrote and finished in 2015, I took three churches, and Mren, Paderni, and Zvartnots, and just really didn't even try to impose any big idea on them or on the period of the 7th century or on Armenian architecture, but just tried to let the evidence speak for itself. And sometimes that really produces a complex mess of evidence. But I tried as much as I could to be patient with that complexity and patient with real diversity of the evidence, and it really pays off. So that for me, that's really fun. Like, I take tremendous pleasure in that really careful looking. So and that's again something art historians do. We look closely, we read closely, and that really helped me build ultimately what I think was a good sort of larger interpretation of Armenian architecture in the 7th century. But it's, for me, that's my working method. So, for example, I'm going to start, maybe this is going to be another question you're going to ask me, but I'm starting a new book, and I've been kind of floundering, what do I want to say, you know, it's going to be about Ani somehow. But I suddenly got really comfortable when I decided I'm just going to start looking at the inscriptions. So that's what I'm doing, and just one by one. And it's that. So that's, for me, always my way in. It's through just looking at the granular, the details, and not really details, but the small scale evidence.
So you would look at in particular just at the Cathedral of Ani, let's say, when we're talking about the city of Ani, and just looking at the cathedral and reading those inscriptions.
Yeah.
And...
So. For me, I mean, Ani is obviously, you could talk about Ani in so many different periods, but for me, I love the Bagratid period. So that's, you know, 10th, 11th centuries for Ani. And, what I'll probably continue to do once I finish my Sirenians chapter, which should be done maybe by tomorrow. We'll see if I can get those last footnotes done. I will go and pick up my inscription catalog, that wonderful series Corpus Inscriptionum Armenicarum, and I will just look at the inscriptions and look probably at the 10th, 11th century inscriptions, and, you know, so start that way and look at Ani Cathedral, probably look at some of the wonderful geographical descriptions that there are from before the genocide, so like late 19th, early 20th century descriptions and the drawings as well. So that's probably where I'll start, since obviously I can't go anywhere right now either. But yeah,
well,
but that's, I love that kind of close work. That's what I like to do. I'm the last person to kind of come up with a big picture idea. That comes last for me. So.
And what happened is, I mean, it's through that sort of close-up look that You've come up with some recent discoveries at Ani, and it just reminds me, I've myself had been able to visit Ani. It's one of the great memories in my lifetime is visiting Ani.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you most people, I think, it'd be fair to say, would not really recognize that most of the churches in Ani are painted on the inside with frescoes, in particular Tigran Honens and Surpurgic.
Right.
But you recently discovered some new things at Ani. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I found some some new paintings at Ani. Of course, they were there before, and they were surely known before I found them. But I sort of discovered them, I guess, in a modern context. So anyway, it is a long story. But I was looking at some old it's not old, but my photographs that I'd taken over the years from Ani Cathedral. And to preface this, I take a lot of pictures of what appears to be just nothing, like white walls, and people probably think I'm crazy, but I do that because I learned when I was working at Meren that if you take a picture of white plaster on an Armenian church, first of all, take the picture, and second of all, when you go home, you can use software to really kind of pull out images. And so I started to do that with Ani Cathedral, where it's clear there's a lot of what appears to be sort of white or fairly dirty plaster in the area of the apse. And so, lo and behold, last summer I was doing that and found this wonderful ox staring at me. So and that was just the beginning, because I was able then to start kind of working through, okay, what do we see here on the apse? Because, as you know, Armenian art follows specific kinds of traditions. It's not just random, and it's not just the invention of the artist. There's certain kinds of images that appear in certain places, and so there's a tradition of artistic production. So I was able to sort of put together a clear sense of what that image looked like. And it's not the only one, as you said before, it's not just Ani Cathedral, but the beautiful church of St. Gregory Abu-Ghamrens, or is that sometimes what it's called, Abu-Ghamrens Church, the little one that's sort of petite and is right on the edge of the cliff, that's often, you'll often see pictures of it. That that's also covered in frescoes, and so I was able to use software to find out much more. And even at churches like the Church of Gregory Tigran Honens, there's a lot more there than appears if you start using software. So even though, those frescoes, a lot of them are known, there are more. And so there's much more work to be done there as well.
Do you find a unifying factor in the program, for instance, at Ani? What if you took Ani's interior as a whole and you compared it to Akhtamar, which you could say, all right, themes of the New Testament, let's say, in a general sense, was there some unifying factor at Ani that you saw, the cathedral?
At Ani Cathedral? So Ani Cathedral, to me, it's very much a kind of a vision of God, a throne vision. So it's an image that is informed by Old Testament visionary accounts, like Ezekiel, maybe Isaiah to some extent. So it is, I think it's meant to sort of show to the viewer a vision of God, and so the painting shows you this vision. And I think actually that may also be the case at that little St. Gregory Church as well, because although I need to get back there to get some better photographs, from what I can tell, some of the same imagery shows up there. So I think that this was a theme at Ani, at least at these two churches, this idea of a vision of God enthroned, surrounded by the creatures, the ox and the eagle and the lion.
Right, so the huge, huge Christ Pantocrator, right, in the apse, this huge, I mean, it's really amazing to see it, even in the condition of the cathedral. But I was going to ask you about St. Gregory of Abu-Ghamrens. When I visited last, probably 3 years ago, it was in the midst of a renovation. So have you had a chance to see it since? Or?
No, my last trip was in 2016. In fact, I was just leaving leaving Istanbul. I was actually in Kars for the attempted coup. So I don't know if I've seen, maybe I've seen some pictures, but
There was scaffolding on the outside when I had
visited. And there wasn't any. When were you there, Barlow?
That had to be 2000, I think, 15 probably. 15 or 16, now that I'm trying to think of it myself. I can't remember exactly which year it was, but it was well underway. I mean, reconstruction was well underway.
I'm trying to remember. I can't remember seeing the scaffolding, but I do remember there had been some construction there, sort of reconstruction. I don't think any of it affected the interior, so that's good. But that church is covered in painting. So, you know, just like Sürpürgitch too. And that also, in both cases, and in Ani Cathedral and in Tigranhonense, there are also the issues of how do you stabilize that painting? What do you do with it, first of all? And then how do you stabilize it? Sürpürgitch is the most worrying, the Church of the Savior, because it's exposed to the elements.
And you in particular, in the last few years, had brought to the world's attention the condition of the cathedral at Meran.
Yeah.
Could you tell us briefly what the situation is today and what led up to it and what is the situation?
Sure. So Meran is a beautiful church right on the closed border of the Turkish Republic and Armenia, and it's on the Turkish side, and it's, for those of listeners who don't know, it's a really important church of the 7th century Armenian church that testifies to Byzantine-Armenian relations and the careers of local princes. It's a massive church that's also sculpted, inscribed, so it's well chronicled in the sources. It has a whole painting program. I mean, it's really a sort of just superb example of Armenian architecture. But in the early 2000s, it started to collapse. In fact, already in the 1990s, there was a collapse of part of the corner of the church. And actually, the Elbrechts, do you remember Richard and Anne Elbrecht?
Oh, very much so, because they've donated to our program, and we have our site. Yeah, right.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
So, they took a picture that showed the collapse of I think it was the southwest corner, and what that started, that was in the 1990s. What that started was basically the progressive collapse of the whole south facade, and so as so often happens, you know, you're on the internet and all of a sudden you learn something that you didn't know. It happens all the time. But I remember thinking, I want to work on this church, Meran. I want to write a book about it. And then all of a sudden realizing that, oh, wait, this guy, I think his name was Gagik Arzumanyan, took a picture and put it up on one of those crowdsourced, picture sites, like, what was this one, Panoramio or something? And it showed that the entire south facade had come down. I had no idea. So that was a moment for me, Barlow, when I realized I have to be more than just an art historian. I have to be an advocate, and I have to be a custodian as well. You know, I have to, because if I don't, then, you know, why am I doing this?
We're going to hold on to that thought, because we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking about Meran. So we'll take a brief break on All Things Armenian. We'll be back with Christina Moranci in just a minute.
Oh,
Tune in to All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Demirgerdichyan. We were listening to Haberban, which was performed by the Yerevan Women's Choir of Armenia under the direction of conductor Artur Varanyan. It's a beautiful album of songs by the Yerevan Women's Choir of Armenia. My guest today on All Things Armenian is Dr. Christina Maranci. She is a professor of Armenian art and architecture, holder of the chair, the Dadian Ostemel Chair in Armenian Art and Architecture at Tufts University. Thank you for joining me again today.
Thank you for having me, Barlo.
So right before the break, we were talking about Maren and mm-hmm. your involvement in wanting to become more of a proactive person in that. So I want to continue that story.
Yeah. So after I saw the collapse of the South Facade, I just realized, you know, I can't be the armchair art historian that I sort of had was being, and so I need to get more involved. And it was quite clear that I needed to do something before this monument collapses, because just kind of on an existential level, why am I being an art historian? Why am I studying things if I'm going to let them collapse? Somehow it just seemed to me to be something really wrong with that. And it's not just about the structure, it's about the whole history that goes with it. That south facade that collapsed was covered in inscriptions dating from the 10th to the 13th centuries. And that will, although some of them have been transcribed, will never get back the archaeological validity of that side of the building and the history that went with it. So a whole chapter of history fell when that south facade fell. So I started by trying to give lectures about the situation at Maren, and also to apply for Maren to be on what's called the watch list of the World Monuments Fund. And the watch list is a sort of emergency list of monuments that are in need of action. So it was on the watch list for 3 years. It was accepted to the watch list, and it was on the watch list for 3 years, in which time there was the first phase of work, which is laser scanning of the entire site, interior, exterior, all the walls. So that was good. You know, that ended, I think 2015 to 2018 was the period.
So who actually was able to do that?
I'm sorry, say it again?
Who actually was able to do that?
So that's the tricky part. And that was my, in a way, a kind of my introduction to the problem of cultural heritage. And so it was done through money from the Ambassador's Fund of the Department of State in the U.S. And that money was went through the World Monuments Fund, and then the Ministry of Tourism and Culture in Turkey surely had to sign off on it, and probably we used their technicians. And so that's how it got done. World Monuments Fund works to sort of connect grant givers to, in this case, to the ministry, to make these projects happen. And so it wasn't a big grant, but it was like $50,000, but that was enough to do this work. But that was phase one. And now I'm trying to figure out second phase before the monument collapses. So it's great to have that data because then you know exactly what it looked like, although I don't want to use the past tense. But you need to, you obviously want to do some kind of physical intervention. And that's hard at Marin because, as you probably know, there are no roads there. It's just a one rocky, long plateau, nothing around it. And you have to get through a ravine, from the nearest village to even get on, back onto the plateau and towards the church again. So it's really difficult. Even with the all-terrain vehicle, you basically ruin it trying to get to the church. So, creating the opportunity for getting equipment out there, getting people out there is hard. That's part of the problem. The other problem, of course, is that this is an Armenian monument in Turkey, and so that's obviously going to be an impediment to its restoration. But having said that, I'm still trying. I'm still sending emails to the World Monuments Fund and trying to reignite interest in work at Marin. But Marin, as you also know, Barlow, is only one of so many monuments that are in emergency condition on the Turkish side in western Armenia. So Ani Cathedral isn't in great shape either. Marin, in fact, is now starting to develop cracks on its northern side. So that means that, you know, the same cracks that happened on the southern side that were the beginning of the fall, the collapse of the south wall, that's now happening on the north wall. And then, you know, those are just the famous churches. There's so many others that that are in the same kind of precarious condition. So my one of the things that I do is try to give lectures on the subject, try to work directly with World Monuments Fund to get something done, and also to train students. And I'm finding that students, undergraduates, but also master's students, are really interested in cultural heritage. They're interested in preservation. They're interested in the politics, in the economics, the ethics, and the architecture and art. So it's funny how the new interest of mine and the new mission of mine sort of also informed my pedagogy, and I think made medieval art a very real and very topical issue for students who might not immediately think of it that way.
Have you ever been able to get any conversation or any interest at all from Turkish art historians? I just was wondering.
From Turkish, from the ministry or from, I didn't hear the last word.
Yeah, just Turkish, let's say a Turkish scholar in Kars, I don't know, maybe at Ankara University. Has anybody ever
absolutely.
Reached
yeah,
out?
Yeah, there is, for sure.
Yeah,
professors, students, scholars who are interested in the Armenian heritage. And so that's good. It's not so much, so there are, I have individual relationships that are like that are great. It's more the institutional problems that I encounter. But I'm an optimist, Barlow. I do think that, you know, if I try hard enough, something's going to happen. So I just keep trying, and that's all I can do.
Now, you've written several monographs on different aspects of Armenian art, and the most recent one was The Art of Armenia, so that's an introduction. Can you tell us a little bit about that book and what prompted you?
Sure. So I wrote that after about 15 years of teaching the survey course that I've designed on Armenian art, and I wanted an accompanying text. I wanted a text that would capture all the wonderful secondary scholarship that's been done. I wanted a text that students could read and non-specialists could read, but also Armenian scholars and non-scholars could read and enjoy, that took a scholarly perspective on Armenian art and culture. So that's what I did, and I it's divided up in chronologically, starting with pre-Christian period, and it goes all the way up to a final postscript on memory and heritage. And it's really meant to be, just as it says, a kind of introduction, so a starting point. And so for my students, for example, who are interested in Cilicia, you know, well, what can they, how can they further examine that field. And so I give bibliography. I try to raise questions as much as kind of give any kind of authoritarian, this is what Armenian art is. Because I think we all know, you know, that kind of, we've all heard that kind of narrative. This happened, and then this happened, and then this is this. But I wanted to, and this is how I teach too, I wanted students to be curious and ask questions and follow their nose. And so that's the kind of book I've tried to create.
And in the research, and over the years, you've done obviously so much research in the field. What do you come to the conclusion, or it's not a conclusion because you're still working on it, but
yeah.
The role of Armenian art in, you know, mm-hmm. in world art and in,
yeah.
in
oh,
where do you,
great.
How do you place yeah. it and what do you do?
So it's a great question, a great subject. And the beautiful thing about art history is that it's changed so much in the past 20 to 30 years. And whereas, you know, 1980s or 1990s, we really wouldn't be able to talk so easily about that subject, or, you know, Armenians would understand it, but nobody else would. The fact that there's, you know, the global turn, that people are looking, that they understand art history isn't just about the Mediterranean, it's not just about France, it's not just about Italy, but it's about the whole world. I don't think there's a better culture than Armenia to show that. And so I think, you know, whether we're talking about New Julfa, or whether we're talking about Urartu, or we're talking about Ani, or we're talking about Akhtamar, or the amazing monastic complexes, you can put Armenia into a much broader frame of reference, whether it's to do with architectural similarities, whether it's about history, whether it's about the trade routes, whether it's about, you know, travelers. So I think I have a kind of dream course that I would teach if somebody would let me. Maybe I'll teach it one of these days. That would be sort of art history. The whole of art history is told through Armenia, because you could really do it. I think it's just amazing. And again, now that we've kind of put down this idea that there's a canon of art history and nothing much happens outside of Italy or France, that we can, you know, accept that places like Armenia were doing things that are pretty amazing, and just as worthy of study, just as interesting, and even more so since they've been ignored for so long by art history.
Have you ever wanted to teach in Armenia, actually, or have you taught in Armenia?
I haven't. Well, I haven't taught in Armenia, but I've thought about it, and I have a friend, Satenik Chukazusian, who's actually the UNESCO, my sort of sister chair in Yerevan. She has the UNESCO chair of art history. I think it's Yerevan State. I should know that.
Well, that's Levon's daughter, right?
Yeah. And so she and I have talked about maybe teaming up and doing something, maybe an exchange program for us. but we haven't. It's not gotten any farther than that. But I think it would be really fun, because I learned so much from my Armenian colleagues, and I think I have stuff to share. So it's a win-win. I think maybe I'll try one of these days when we can travel again.
But even now, I mean, now that we're doing so much online, I always think about doing things jointly. You know, setting up. The time is a different bit of a problem, but to set up something you can very easily do a Zoom or whatever meeting you want to do, and it'd be interesting to do that.
I think it's a great idea. I also think another thing I'd love to do is teach an Armenian art course for not just for students, but for the Armenian community more generally. I'd love to make something like that available, because, you know, I have a particular disciplinary perspective on it, and that might be interesting. So these are things that I have been floating around in my head.
That's great. Well, our conversation today has been with Dr. Christina Maranci. She's the Dadian Ostemel Professor of Armenian Art at Tufts University. We've been talking about so many different and interesting things. And actually, I have invited Christina to speak in the fall, and she's agreed. So we'll be publicizing that as we get a little closer to the fall semester at Fresno State. We'll be doing it online virtually. But thank you so much for joining me today, Christina.
My pleasure, Barlow. Thank you so much. Thanks. This has been an absolute pleasure and honor.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure on my part as well. And for all things Armenian, this is Professor Barlow Dermagradishian, and wishing you a good week, and we'll see you on our next episode next Sunday.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Este fue un programa pagado y solo refleja la opinión de sus anunciantes. Ahora continúa disfrutando de la programación de 1600 AM.